Those who were here last week remember then that we got at the book of Zechariah from sort of way out and are zeroing in on the thing, and that we tried to establish the setting of the book in terms of, first of all, the broad Near Eastern flow of empires, and then we tried to identify, and we started by noting in the introductory verses of Zechariah the reference to the second year of Darius, and so that's where we are in history with the ministry of Zechariah, and for that matter also of Haggai, his contemporary. And so what we're looking for is the context of this second year of Darius the Medo-Persian king, and so we try to establish that in terms of the whole succession of empires. And then we also took another layer of this instead of just the bare history of dates and so on. We tried to get a sort of a biblical theological understanding of this historical setting by working into the picture the messages of Daniel, who of course comes so shortly before Zechariah, and they interact with one another. And so in terms of Daniel's visions in chapter 2 and 7, where he deals with this succession of empires, and we were noting, of course, that this Darius figure in this second year of Darius, in terms of Daniel's sequence of four world empires, would fit in with that second one, the Medo-Persian one, which he describes in chapter 2 in terms of the breast of silver, the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar, the breast and arms of silver representing Medo-Persia. And so in terms of the whole perspective of Daniel 2 and 7, we of course see that this second year of Darius was a time then when the world was characterized by, well, what Daniel 7 would be calling bestial empires, beast empires. And in chapter 7 of Daniel, the Medo-Persian kingdom would be represented by that bear, which is raised up on one side and so on. And or if we went on to Daniel 8, which we didn't do, in Daniel 8, you get some other symbolism of the Medo-Persian empire and the Greek Empire, and in Daniel 8, the Medo-Persian Empire is pictured as a ram, and it has its history, and it's overcome then by the he-goat representing Greece. So we were trying to fill in some of this assessment of the nature of the kingdom of the Medo-Persians in terms of this structure, and then also with Daniel, we worked in the angle of Daniel 7 and or 9 rather, and the 70 weeks passage, and try to see then how Zechariah and Haggai are functioning within what would be that first period of the seven sevens, that first jubilee period that we find in Daniel 9, which involved then the answer to Daniel's prayer for the restoration of the city of Jerusalem and the temple. And so that first week the first 7 weeks of the 70 weeks represent a time then when God was undertaking to restore Jerusalem and the temple, excuse me, and so Zechariah fits in within that frame of reference as well. And well, I just wanted to develop a little bit more sharply now some of this and the particular focus then that we have with from the point of Cyrus on. Well, we talked about Assyria, and then there was the Neo-Babylonian kingdom, and which is Nebuchadnezzar and so forth, of course. And then that brought us to the Medo-Persian thing with Cyrus. coming on the scene, and then there would be the other empires, Greece, Rome, about 333 and so on, representing the rise of Greece. And within the book of Zechariah, that development is hovering around the edges, the way that Greece would be rising up presently. And so in the middle of the 4th century, we have Alexander taking over, and then toward the end of the 1st century, we have Rome taking over. So here were the Daniel's three world empires who all were dominating the people of God, starting then with Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And that would be back in let's say, 605, which is the opening date, actually, in the book of Daniel itself, when Daniel was taken into captivity. And so from that point on, we have the exile. The 70 years that were predicted by Jeremiah 25 and Jeremiah 29, and presently now when we're studying the first vision of Zechariah, we're going to see a reference to this period of the 70 years of exile, which then is, on my understanding of it, it extends, it's a round number, from 605 down to Cyrus, and Cyrus then is 539. So there is your 70 years exile takes place. And from this point on, the Davidic dynasty, the Messianic dynasty, is no longer in place. And as a matter of fact, does not reemerge through any of this long history now, the Old Testament. And it's only then in terms of the coming of Christ, and now at an anti-typical level, that the Davidic dynasty is restored. And so here are the world empires then that dominate the Davidic dynasty. And in fact, that's why Daniel starts here rather than with Assyria, because under the Assyrians, although that they back in 622 had overcome the northern kingdom and Samaria fell, that the Davidic dynasty was still in place, and that was the case until 605. And so Daniel therefore starts his portrayal of the world dominating the people of God with Babylon. That's the first empire, and then the Medo-Persians are the second, and so forth. We also went into the thought that if you are working on the 70 weeks passage in Daniel 2 and 7, then when you come to the fourth beast, there's stage A, and then there's 4B, because once the typological stage is over and you're no longer have the kingdom of God identifiable with a particular chunk of geography there, then it's no longer such a simple matter to identify who is the world power. Up until that point, whatever world power is dominating the domain of that should be that of the Davidic dynasty, that kingdom is the great evil empire of the day. But when we come to the end of the Old Testament order, which you do in 70 A.D., and in principle, of course, with the cross, even before that, when the new covenant is established, from that point on, then it's not such a simple matter any longer to identify what is this beast empire. So stage 4B, represented now not by just the 10 horns, but by the little horn, or in chapter 2, represented not just by the legs of iron, but by the feet. There's that beast age, which is represented in the symbolism. When we come to that, then we must broaden our definition of what is the little horn power, to put it in general terms, which I would say is that wherever, whenever the nations of the world show themselves to be oppressive and suppressing the people of God, opposing the progress of the gospel, that is stage B here. And that's the fourth beast in his little horn. The stage of affairs. But now we are dealing now then with something which is in the second year of Darius. We're within the Medo-Persian Empire. And so you begin there with Cyrus. And he was followed then by his son Cambyses in 530. And then next after him was Darius. And now that's where we are now. So we're within this focus of world history in terms of Daniel's assessment of things. And we have a succession of kings now And in particular, to the second year of Darius would be 520. His first year was 522. And so the second year of Darius that we're dealing with is 520. He was followed by Xerxes, and he in turn by Artaxerxes. And so the next thing then that we would want to do was just be to develop a little more sharply this particular period of our world history in order to zero in now on this year 520 to see what was the nature of things here. And the first way I'll do it is see the analysis of what was going on during this period as presented in the book of Ezra, in chapter 4 and chapter 5 of Ezra. And in these chapters, Ezra takes up the story here with Cyrus. And in chapter 4, the theme is the opposition that God's people encountered. Now, you remember back in Daniel's prophecy that the decree has already gone forth, which was in the year 539. Cyrus issued the decree. Already God in heaven had issued the decree. And before the year is out, in answer to Daniel's prayer, the decree comes to expression in the decree of Cyrus in 539. And so Ezra picks up the story from that point, but the first theme he deals with is how, in spite of the progress that was made, and that's what I started to say, that Daniel tells us things would be underway, and by the time this first Jubilee period would be over, Daniel's prayer would be answered, and the temple would be restored, and the city would be restored. But he adds, in distress of the times. It wasn't going to be all easy, even though Cyrus issued a decree that they could go back. There are all kinds of trouble. And so Ezra 4 has the theme of the opposition, the people who had been in the land before the Jews who returned did so. The Samaritan opposition, we may say, is the theme in Ezra 4. And so the way then in chapter 5, it's going to be how, in spite of the distress of the times, to put it in Daniel's terms, the work was actually completed. And when you're studying Ezra 4 and 5, it's very important to see how this is another illustration of the thing I often point out, that the biblical historians will often develop the history not just in straightforward chronological order, but in terms of themes. And so in chapter 4 of Ezra, the theme is that of the opposition that was encountered by the Jews as they tried to restore the temple, and including then during the days of our prophet Zechariah. And so he begins then in the first about five verses of Ezra 4 to make the point that in spite of the fact that under Cyrus a decree was issued that they should return, that there still was opposition to the building of the temple all the days of Cyrus. Opposition to the building of the temple all the days of Cyrus. And then still in that fifth verse, chapter 4 of Ezra, still in the fifth verse, he says, even until the reign of Darius. And so from Cyrus all the way through the reign of Cambyses, and into the reign of Darius, where we are with Zechariah, this opposition then to the building of the temple continued until the reign of Darius. Then he doesn't, however, develop anything positive at that point that happened during the reign of Darius, because his theme now is that of opposition. When we come to chapter 5, his theme will be success, and then he will go back and tell us some good things that happened during the reign of Darius. But while he's dealing with the theme of opposition, he just sticks to that. And so he moves right on then in verse 6 to speak about what happened during the reign of the next king here, which is Xerxes, and tells us how an accusation was written to this King Xerxes at the beginning of his reign, giving the Jews still more grief. And then he goes on to say something that happened during the reign of Artaxerxes, the next king. Xerxes started to rule in 486 and Artaxerxes in 465. And during the reign of Artaxerxes, then, we are told that a letter was sent to him in opposition to the building. And now here it's important to notice the change from the temple, which is the object of opposition in the first part of the story. And now there is opposition to the building of the city and the walls. And that's mentioned in Ezra 4, verses 7 through 16. And in fact, Artaxerxes, we are told in verses 17 through 23, decreed that this work should cease on the city and the walls. Okay, now the right there is where you have to be alert and see the transition. In Ezra chapter 4, verse 24, verse 23 tells you that the work ceased, and it's referring to the city and the walls. And then right away in the next verse, verse 24, it says, "Then ceased the work." And you might think, well, you're continuing the story right beyond where you were, but as a matter of fact, what has happened now is you've gone back here now to the beginning again, and because the text actually says, "Then ceased the work on the temple." And so now we are back to that story, the story that left off back in verse 5, when it said that there was opposition to the temple all the days of Cyrus. And then 5b, even until the reign of Darius. Now, what we have then is in Ezra 4:24, it goes back and it picks up that business. It picks up the story with Cyrus and Darius. Now to tell us how, in spite of all the troubles that have just been recited, the work actually then did go forward. So Ezra 4:24 now tells us, "Then ceased the work on the temple until the second year of Darius." You see, it is repeating that story, not picking up where it had ended down here. And it goes on from there. But now that brings us then right to where we want to be, which is the second year of Darius. "Then ceased the work on the temple." It had been begun under Cyrus, and however then ceased until the second year of Darius, and in his reign. And now the story goes on in Ezra 5 and following. It tells us how Darius confirmed the decree of Cyrus. Cyrus had decreed that there should be the restoration, and now we find that Darius confirmed that decree, and that the temple, see here we're back on the story of the temple, and that the temple was finished there in the sixth year of Darius. So Zechariah is dated in the second year, at least the opening visions there are dated in the second year of Darius, and the work on the temple moves forward again, and by the sixth year of Darius, it had been completed. And then the treatment in the book of Ezra goes on. What I just said covered chapters 5 and 6. And now, having dealt with this reign of Darius and how the temple was built, it then skips down here again to this later period under Artaxerxes in chapter 7 of the book of Ezra, and tells us now about the ministry of Ezra. So here you can see how much later the Ezra and Nehemiah are than Zechariah. Zechariah is functioning back here under the reign of Darius, and in 520 or so. And now you're, upwards of a century later, when Ezra comes upon the scene as described in Ezra 7, he is sent in the seventh year of this Artaxerxes with offerings for the temple service and so on. And then still later, in the 20th year of this Artaxerxes, Nehemiah is sent on his ministry, and Artaxerxes is involved now through Nehemiah in once again rebuilding the city and the walls. So you follow carefully and you see then that the earlier period, whether it's talking about opposition or success, it has to do with the temple. And then when you come down to this later period, it's opposition to the city and the walls and success in building the city and the walls under the reforms of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, if you read the critical literature, you see there's a lot of debate about what is the actual sequence of Ezra and Nehemiah, and many would suggest that Nehemiah comes before Ezra and so on. It's a very involved thing. Years ago, I made a study. This is one thing I convinced Cyrus Gordon of. Cyrus Gordon, in classes I was, he's the one that did my doctoral work with, and he was doing a history of the Persian period or so on, and he came in class and he accepted the sort of the current view that Nehemiah came before Ezra, which really is not what the Bible seems to be saying. And the next week I came to a class where the had made out the whole case, and he let me take over and put it on the board, and I convinced him that the author Ezra and Nehemiah was the right one. By the way, those of you who know Cyrus Gordon, I just got word a month or so ago that he died. He was up in his 90s and still very vigorous, doing Near Eastern language studies and so very unusual fellow. Had all kinds of Christian students through the years, but he gave no evidence ever, of becoming a believer in the Lord. But a very able fellow and very profitable to study. Well, in any case, this then is the structure of things as Ezra chapter 4 and 5 presented to us. Now, if we can just maybe zero in still more sharply now, here's something that included all of the Medo-Persian kings. But let's now then just focus a little more sharply now on the period that we're concerned with from 520 on. When under Darius things get going again in the second year of his reign, and then by the sixth year of his reign, which is down in 515, the temple actually was completed. So let's just fill that in, and it will involve, once again, we did do this last week. Remember, we were trying to show the relationship of Zechariah to Haggai. We suggested that, and obviously Haggai does come on the scene a few weeks before Zechariah, and he seems to be an older man and ready to complete his ministry. But before he does, there's this overlapping with Zechariah, who apparently is a young man at this time. So it's interesting just to see the sequence of date formulae in Haggai and Zechariah and how they mesh with one another. So here we are then in 520, this second year of Darius. And it was in the sixth month and the first day of that second year of Darius that we have Haggai starting his ministry. So when Haggai urges now the rebuilding of the temple, here's the story then that Ezra was telling in chapter 5, how once again, after a time when the temple had been started but had been fallen into a lack of interest and progress, then it resumes again here under Darius, and that's there what Haggai is concerned about right away. Haggai 1:1, urging the people now to rebuild the temple. A few days later, on the sixth month and the 24th day, it says then in Haggai 1:15 that the temple began. That was quick success for the preacher. Huh? He urges it there. And a few weeks later, they're actually doing something about it, and the temple is begun. And the next date is, again, less than a month later, seventh month of this, all under this second year of Darius. The seventh month, the 21st day, Haggai 2, verse 1. Now, here the temple has started, and this becomes the occasion then for a prophecy by Haggai of the future of this temple as something which is going to be glorious. Now, this right away introduces us into the kind of hermeneutical question that we have to deal with in every page of the prophets as we work through the visions repeatedly. we'll be looking at the way in which the prophecy speaks in terms of these Old Testament phenomena, like the Old Testament temple, and prophesies the things which, in the nature of the case, simply can't be reduced to that Old Testament level, but which are obviously dealing with the ultimate realities that were just symbolized by the Old Testament temple. And so in this particular instance, in Haggai 2:1, the glory of the new temple is then one that certainly involves what was going to happen in the Messianic age. Then that next date we're interested in brings us to our friend Zechariah. So in the eighth month and the first day, Zechariah now picks up on Haggai's ministry, and Zechariah now urges repentance, and we'll look again at that introduction, and reminds the people of the folly of their fathers, and urges them not to repeat that, and calls them to a new way. And so that's 8:1. The next month, ninth month, 24th day, we're back to Haggai again, Haggai 2. And now in terms of the contemporary situation, he had urged them to build the temple. They actually did get going on it, and it speaks now about the foundations of the temple were laid. So within just a few months, they're making that kind of progress, at least again here, the foundations were laid. And this becomes another occasion, like the preceding one we mentioned, where Haggai then breaks into a prophecy of all ultimate things and the overthrow of all the nations and so on. And all right. And that's the last we hear of Haggai. But meanwhile, Zechariah now has come into the picture. And the opening six verses were dated in the eighth month, the first day. And now we come to our night visions, which, of course, is our main subject of concern. And it's now the 11th month of Darius' second year and the 24th day. In terms of the calendar, it now is the year 519. But it's still the second year of Darius in terms of this other reckoning. And here are the night visions of Zechariah. So Zechariah 1:7 on through, let's say, just simplify for the moment, through chapter 6. Now just two more dates. That was 519. Now next one is the year 518. In terms of the reign of Darius, it's his fourth year. So in the fourth year of Darius, we are told, in the ninth month, on the fourth day. And now this brings us beyond the night visions of Zechariah to the section that starts in chapter 7, verse 1, which, when we get to our discussion of the structure, we'll see is a second introduction, this one an introduction to the burdens, chapters 9 through 12. But chapter, the fourth year, the ninth month, and the fourth day, it's in the year 518. We read about a certain deputation that comes with a question, and Zechariah deals with that, and that covers chapters 7 and 8. And then the final thing we'll mention is indeed the actual completion. So under Haggai and Zechariah, they were urged to get going on the temple. They actually did so. This became the occasion of broad-ranging prophecies. Then not only about the immediate fortune of the Old Testament, the temple and city, but moving beyond and into very rich messianic prophecies about Christ and his church. Then 515, the sixth year of Darius, as Ezra rehearsed it back here in Ezra 5, in the sixth year of Darius, the 12th month, the third day, the temple was finished. Ezra 6, verses 14 and 15. So this then is the focus we want to move into. Okay. Now you can see that even with the developments under Zechariah and Haggai and the progress that was made, that's then 80 years or so go by and become down to Ezra and Nehemiah, and the things have taken steps backward again, certainly in terms of the building of completing of the city and the walls. All right, now then, moving on. What should we do next? I think now what we want to do is to get into the structure of the book, I guess. So, in your Glory in Our Midst, which I hope you have handy, this will be the appendix. And let's see. Well, I think the way to go about this then would be to work through this article, which you have as an appendix. And in the process of doing that, we will also then be doing a walk through the whole book so that we'll have a general idea of the contents of the whole book of Zechariah, the development of themes and the patterns and the structures of things, just in a broad way. And, well, I guess I can erase this mess, yes? The other thing we did last week, one other layer that we added along with just the straightforward analysis of the succession of empires and Daniel's treatment of them in chapters 2 and 7 and 9. One other thing we did then was to try to show in terms of the overall structure of the covenants where Zechariah fits into the picture, and we will be constantly coming back to that necessarily because of the precisely of the things that are being predicted, that Daniel had predicted and that are predicted within Zechariah, namely that in spite of this restoration that is taking place here under Haggai and Zechariah during the reign of Darius, yeah, wonderful restoration, Daniel's prayer in Daniel 9 is being answered, and alas, that was not the end of the story. And once again, things go downhill, covenant is broken, there's apostasy, and so 70 AD is a final event in that story. And so we end up in covenant history with the fall of Israel. And we have to be able to account for the fall of Israel in terms of our whole analysis of especially then of the covenant of grace, you know, which after the fall takes place and continues on through history, and there's no room in terms of just the principle of grace for the fall of Israel. And so there's the whole business then of when you come to the Mosaic covenant, the old covenant, to recognize that at that dimension of the typological aspect of the Mosaic economy, there was a works principle operating, do this and you will live. And that is in terms of that works principle at that typological level, and only in terms of that, that you can account for this fall of Israel that Daniel speaks about, and that Zechariah, we will find, speaks about. And so, right away in the introduction, we are going to come upon this works principle, do this and you will live, return unto me and I will return unto you, is the language right away in Zechariah. And so that's going to be another constant interest that we have as we work our way through the exegesis. These two types of problem I've already mentioned, and hermeneutically, the recognition of the way in which the prophets speak not only of the contemporary situation, but the way they use the contemporary situation in order to portray the messianic realities, what I call then prophetic idiom, using the present phenomena as symbols of the antitypical phenomena. That's the one big hermeneutical thing that's going on all the time. And the other thing is this constant dealing with the principles of works and grace within the structure of the covenant. Well, now when we look at the book of Zechariah, we didn't say much about the authorship, and we needn't in the history of the discussion. Of course, the modern critical view is not one that is ready to accept the Zechariah authorship of all the material that we have here. In the older days, there was an effort to attribute Zechariah material to pre-exilic times even. Now, of course, the greater emphasis is to regard much of Zechariah, especially then the burdens in chapter 9 through 14 as being much later than Zechariah. And now what I've, and in connection with that, of course, there is at stake the whole question of the unity of the book. And as you read through Zechariah yourself, I'm sure are impressed with how different the material is when you come to chapter 9 and following from what has gone before. And well, how to account for that is just a different sort of genre that Zechariah has adopted, something that is was something that he produced later in his life. As we said, at the beginning, he's obviously a young man. And maybe then later in life, he adds the rest, and that would account for the differences. One way or another, we're prepared to recognize that. But many modern critics, of course, don't want to recognize that, and they see the different nature of chapters 9 through 14 as evidence of a different author altogether, or several of them. And there are even commentaries then that are produced in such a way that there's a closer connection in their treatment of things with the last chapters of Zechariah with something like Malachi or so than there is with the first eight chapters of Zechariah. Now, in that connection, then, where the unity of the book is an issue, then I think it's useful to, as I've attempted to do here, to make a study of the structure of the book, which then brings out some of the fascinating patterns that it sounds like Meredith patterns. He's right. To see these patterns that appear all over the book that show the structure not only, let's say, of the night visions and the structure of the burdens by themselves, but the connection between them. And if you read the structure article here in your appendix or someplace else, then you notice how I tried to do this. Canonical Zechariah falls into several fairly distinct divisions: an oracular exhortation, those first six verses, to a series of visions with oracles interlaced, and that's our night visions, a symbolic action performed by the prophet, and that's going to be a key verse right near the end of the last part of chapter 6, and then that second sort of introduction, chapter 7 and 8, oracular instruction, I call it, and then a pair of burdens. So in general, these are the materials then that we're dealing with. And my conclusion then, I stated at once, and then proceed to try to show the evidence for it. But my conclusion was then that the book is a diptych. And this is a diptych, huh? Right? So you have two panels and a spine. All right? And so I think that the book of Zechariah is set up so that it has this central spine, and that central spine is chapter 6, verses, was it 9, through the end of the chapter. It's that vision of the coronation of Joshua. And then on either side of that spine, you have a panel, and then the panels match each other. And moreover, are these two side panels themselves are diptychs. Each one of these side panels has a spine, a central spine, because each of them is divisible into seven parts. And the middle one, the fourth one in each case, is a spine. And so that you have three central spines, the center one, and then the one on either side, on either panel. And so the first thing I try to establish is the common features of these three chapters. On the side of the night visions, the fourth night vision, which would be the spine of the vision diptych, it's the chapter three. The fourth vision is in chapter three. And that too is an account of Messiah, the priest king, in symbolic terms, Joshua symbolizing Messiah and his coronation. And then on the side of the burdens, once again, the middle burden, or the middle section of the two burdens, is chapter 11, where, again, you have the theme of the messianic. Priest and king and his coronation. I'll go through these details a little bit more, but just to describe what the thesis is first. And so the two side panels then match each other in that each one has an introduction. The visions have as their introduction, chapter 1, verses 1 through 6. The burdens, the second side of the basic diptych, have chapters 7 and 8 as their introduction. And then in each case, after the introduction, there is a distinctive form, whether visions or burdens, of which you have 7 in each case, with, as I said, the middle one being a central spine with distinctive features. So how to represent this? This is a challenge. You need different colored chalk or something to do it right, I think. But all right. So here's your central spine. Now this is chapter 6, verses 9 through 15. How to do this? All right. Spines will be crisscrossed. All right. Now on either side of this side. Part of our Bible folding out there. Here are your side panels. Each side panel begins with an introduction section. And then plunk in the middle in each case, and let's do it that way again. There is a spine, so that this itself is a fold-out diptych. And this one would be chapter 3, 1 through 10. And this, as I said, is the central one, 6, 9 through 15. And this is 11, 1 through 17. Okay, so that's the thesis, that's the conclusion of the structure of the book, and I'll want to go and check out some of the details that show what these three sections have in common with one another and which distinguish them from all the rest of the book. All right, and then one other thing by way of developing the structure, I can't go into all of the patterns. You can read the article for more details, but then I want to just take the visions and analyze them in terms of a chiastic structure. All right, so from chapter 1, verse 7, after the opening introduction, right up through the seventh vision. There is an A, B, C, D, C, B, A structured. Now, most commentaries you pick up will speak about eight visions. There aren't eight visions. There are only seven visions, and it's you get eight by dividing improperly chapter 5. And when we come to our detailed discussion of chapter 5, we'll see actually the integrity, the unity, the interlocking, remarkable symbolic interlockings of the all of chapter 5, so that there are only seven visions. And so 1, 2, 3, 4, and of course this 4 is our central hinge there, and 5, 6, 7. But it's chiastically arranged so that the first vision and the seventh correspond, and the second and the sixth and the third and the fifth with the fourth quite distinctive. And the same sort of thing we'll be wanting to do with the burdens. And lo and behold, you have the same sort of thing happening there. And in such a way, moreover, well, let's set them up. That same thing is the structure of the burdens. There's a sevenfold division, not as clear-cut. The divisions in the burdens are not as obvious as with the divisions, but I think it can demonstrate that these are the proper divisions. And once again, you have A, B, C, D, and D here, of course, is this one, the central spine for the burdens. So that here, too, the chapter 9 and chapter 14, let's say, is what we're dealing with, are the two A sections, and there are all these points of correspondence between them, and likewise this way. And so separately, we establish this for the visions and for the burdens. And then the last thing that we show is then the correspondence actually across the board, so that A under the visions corresponds to A under the burdens in all kinds of ways, and right across the board that way. And so it's really, if valid, and I submit to you that it is, it's a really remarkable artistic literary designing that's gone on here. And so in terms of authorship and integrity, I would say, you know, that kind of thing just doesn't happen when someone tacks on some material onto some earlier work. I mean, this has been inwrought into the thing, I would say, from the beginning. But apart from the implications for the subject of authorship, what I think is helpful to us is trying to understand the message is that then to be able to relate corresponding parts of the prophecy to one another and to throw light on the interpretation of things. So, okay, now these are then the two major things that I want to try to give the evidence for. First, this overall form, which is then a matter of arguing for the distinctiveness of these three spine sections over against the rest of the material and their relationship, their similarity to one another. And so if you open your, let's see, the pages I have are for the article, which are not the same as they're in your appendix in the article. Let's see, I've noted that page 179, let me see if I can find a heading at least. Oh, we'll be right near the beginning. Okay, right near, if you have a Your Glory in Our Midst handy. It should be, well, there it is right at the beginning. Your first heading there is the three hinge framework, okay? All right, let's just look at this and forgive me if I follow along here in the text and comment on it if you like or ask questions about it. So a key structural device of the book emerges with a recognition that 6, 9 through 15 shares with two other passages there a peculiar set of formal and thematic characteristics. Common to these passages and to them alone is the formal feature of symbolic action in which the prophet personally participates. and specific historical individuals are involved. Okay, so this is just a formal feature, but it's one that you will discover. You can check it out for yourself, where Zechariah just doesn't receive revelations within these three, but he himself plays a role of one sort or another, whether it's to make suggestions as to how the action should unfold, or in the middle one, for example, in chapter 6, it's where he is the one who plays a key role in the whole procedure of securing the material for and making a crown for the coronation of Joshua and the doing of that and the final disposition of the crown and so on. But Zechariah himself is very much involved in it. And then in the case of chapter 11, the spine in the middle of the burdens, Zechariah is also very much personally involved. In fact, now he's not just directing what's going to happen with the coronation of someone else, but he himself is the one who puts on, in the form of the symbolism of a shepherd putting on the shepherd's gown and so on, and of course shepherd being a symbol of kingship and so on. Zechariah himself plays the messianic role in that one. So there is one a distinctive feature then of these three sections, which you don't get elsewhere. Another feature then that I mentioned is that in these three sections alone, you have human individuals, real persons, who appear elsewhere. The human individuals are symbolized, for example, when we come to the first vision. The human individuals are symbolized by the myrtles. In the first vision, you have the rider on the red horse, which is Christ, and then you have the myrtles, and that represents the covenant community. So these people, but they are present in the form of symbolism, and that's the way it is throughout the book, except in these three chapters here. And here you have reference to actual living persons contemporary with Zechariah or future figures, but a real person. So here are a couple of formal features that set these three sections apart from all of the rest. And beyond the formal features, there are commonality of themes that you have here, very strikingly so. Further, these three passages are thematically unified. In each, the prophet participates in a coronation, as I've already been saying. In a coronation, an investiture to theocratic office. And so here, of course, we have some very interesting and rich messianic prophecy. Here are three major pictures of Christ as a priest king. And, that's what the prophecy that then is keying on, is the figure of Christ and his ministry. And the whole structure of the book is such as to highlight that thing in a very unusual way, so that these three key central parts, whether of the whole book or of the side panels, each zeroes in here on the figure of the Messiah. Indeed, all three portray Messiah's commissioning to his royal priestly task. Moreover, in addition to sharing exclusively this striking set of features, each of these passages occupies a central position, either in the book as a whole or in one of its two main side blocks, as we see here in this chiastic structure. These all appear as the middle section, whether in these two blocks or the middle of the book as a whole. And here I think are some important considerations. Before showing more particularly how each of the three passages in turn exhibits these characteristics, I would like to state at once the hypothesis at which I arrive, and I've already stated it to you. So my proposal is that the book of Zechariah then is a diptych, with 6, 9 through 15 as its primary hinge or central spine, and that the main part of each side panel of this diptych is itself a diptych formation with these other two passages as the hinges of the visions and the burdens. All right, now let's take a quick look at these three central hinge sections. The first then is this one over here in the middle of it's the fourth vision, Zechariah 3, 1 through 10, located in the middle of the night visions. And in fact, so distinctive is this passage in style and substance that some excluded from the numbered sequence of visions and wouldn't count it as one of the visions. But everyone recognizes how distinctive the material is in this third chapter. In my proposal, that special status of chapter 3, the fourth vision, in my numbering, consists in its function as one of the trio of hinges in the macro structure of the book. Now, unlike the visions before and after it, 3:1-9 does not introduce imaginary objects, as we said, to symbolize the earthly realities, but presents actual living persons. It talks about Joshua, the high priest, in Zechariah's day. It talks about his priestly colleagues. It talks about Zechariah presiding over a group of other priestly officials, real persons who are there. And though historical people like the oppressor nations, the Israelites and the exile and so forth are referred to in the other visions in the oracular interpretation of the symbolism, elsewhere within the actual symbols themselves, as we said, you don't have actual living persons, but you have current people being set forth under symbols like the myrtle tree and so on. All right, closely related to this is the other formal point of similarity between Zechariah 3 and the other main hinge sections. Elsewhere in the night vision, Zechariah's role does not go beyond the reception of revelation. That's the point that I've already made to you. But in these three, it does go beyond the reception of revelation to performing the roles that we've already then suggested. This motif of donning royal priestly regalia, in the last in my thing is page 180, this motif of donning royal priestly regalia and acquiring the accoutrements of office is itself one of the features peculiar to the three main hinges. In chapter 3, in the case of Joshua, that's a very interesting thing, you know, remember, now Joshua appears, so you might want to turn your Bibles here to the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord. Satan is standing there to accuse him. And Joshua is described as being present with his filthy garments. And so what follows from that point on then is that in terms of the advocacy of the angel of the Lord, the messianic figure, Satan, the accuser, is rebuked. And provision is made then for the cleansing and restitution of Joshua the high priest. And first then his filthy garments are removed, and that's interpreted in terms of removing of iniquity from him. And all of this by way of the mandate of the messianic, the judge who has now become advocate for the defendant, and who explains the removal of the garments in terms of putting away of sin. But then we come to the investiture part of it. And he is now given new attire. And this new attire is certainly to be understood in terms of his proper high priestly regalia. So it is an investiture now to office as a priest. And then you get the interesting royal symbols that are connected with it. When we come to that chapter, we'll be interested in interpreting the stone which is on the turban of his crown and so forth, and the significance of that. But there is the royal dimension of the thing, as well as the priestly in this high priestly regalia. And so that's what we're talking about then in terms of this first hinge section. So that paragraph then says, in the case of Joshua, the replacement of his soiled attire with garments of holy glory signified his reinstatement as Israel's high priest, thus invested anew with authority for governance, set over the council of priests, as he is, for judicial oversight of God's courts, Joshua was declared a sign of my servant the branch. And so here the text itself plainly tells us that we're dealing here with typology. Joshua was a priest, but he is a sign of my servant the branch, and of course that is a messianic designation. So Joshua typified the coming Messiah in his twofold office, the suffering servant who undergoes extreme humiliation to accomplish a priestly sacrifice for sin, but then experiences the highest exaltation as the royal branch of David. Now those are the ideas that would be connected elsewhere, where you see the concept of the suffering servant and the son of David and the branch of David. Special attention is directed to the mitre bearing the golden gemstone badge of royal priestly dignity, the item for which Zechariah expressed a particular interest, and for good reason. Crowned with this, Joshua prefigured Christ. Christ, the priestly remover of iniquity. Christ, the royal restorer of paradise and of man as God's glory image. Such portrayal of Messiah in his priest-king mission is also found in the other two hinge passages. So, you know, here is where structure is helping to illuminate and to underscore what is important, and what is important is Christ. And, okay. Now then, the second one is the middle one, the central hinge of the whole thing. And if you flip over now to chapter 6, the first verse is in chapter 6 is the seventh vision of the chariots of judgment that go forth from between the two mountains of bronze. And we'll, that's an interesting one that we'll, Lord willing, deal with in due course. And but then, after the conclusion of that one in verse 8, we come to a separate episode altogether, introduced by the thought, the word of the Lord came to me. And now, as we said, there are real persons involved in this, and they are described as such, along with Joshua himself. There are these people that come from exile, Heldai, Tobijah, and Jediah, and this other figure that we'll talk about, what his role is in the whole thing, Josiah ben Zephaniah. And so here's that formal feature that's, as we said, is common to the three hinge sections. Real persons described as real persons here, not just symbolized Joshua and these other figures, but especially then there is the thought of Zechariah's own role as more than receiving revelation, because he proceeds now to receive. Here are these people that come back from exile, representing the exiles who are offering their tribute for what's going on back in the temple and so on. And so they bring their silver and gold, and then they offer it, and it's put in the charge of someone who's in charge of the store treasuries. I think that's the significance of this fellow Josiah, son of Zephaniah, that he is the one who is in charge of the store treasures in the temple, and so he's the logical one to bring the gifts to. And so Zechariah then, however, goes to him and secures these for the purpose of using this particular gift of tribute to construct a crown, which then he proceeds to take the silver and gold, make a crown, and set it on the head of the high priest Joshua, son of Jehozadak. So, of course, this is very much then like the passage we just read, even in terms of the figure of Joshua, the high priest, as the one who undergoes the coronation and the investiture and so on, and with a heavy emphasis here now on the kingly aspect, and also how here is the man whose name is the branch. Now, back in chapter 3, remember, he was said to be a symbol of the branch. Same thing here in this central spine. Here is the man whose name is the branch. He will branch out from his place and build the temple of the Lord, and he will be clothed with majesty, and he will sit and rule. This is an interesting passage when we come to the proper translation of it. I think the proper translation, and is that he will sit and rule by his throne, I think is the proper translation of the thing. I don't know if you have looked at this passage much and or preached on it or studied it, and as to just what is the image here of Christ and his relationship to the Father on his throne. Of course, the New Testament is full of the thought of Christ's session at the right hand of the Father. And in this passage, it is often suggested that here is someone who is a priest and a king, and he's going to be a king on his throne, but he's also going to be a priest on his throne. And in other words, it is thought that the two offices of the priest and the king sort of get personified as two separate people. And so he will be a priest upon his throne. He's there as a king, but he's also there as a priest. I think that's a misunderstanding of the passage. And it isn't, you have two persons indeed, but it's not a personification of the two offices. One person is Christ, the other person is the Father, if you will. And there's the Father's throne. And the picture then is that the Messiah is seated on by the throne of the Father, at the right hand of the Father, by his throne. And so that we'll go through this when we come to it again. But just to get the immediate picture, he will build the temple, be clothed in majesty, and he will sit and rule, not on his throne, on his own throne, the Messiah's throne, but he will sit and rule by God's throne. He has just referred to the Lord's temple. Now he refers to the Lord's throne. All right. And there will be the harmony between, peace, shalom between the two of them, and so on. So, all right. But very clearly, then, here is another passage that shares fully in the characteristics that we're trying to develop thematically here of investiture to a royal priestly office. Clearly evident from the above comments is the presence then here of the thematic distinctive of the hymn sections, the coronation investiture of a messianic prototype. This motif, obvious in the crowning act, may also be alluded to in the statement. We can jump over that. Moreover, as the coronation is the commissioning of one who typifies Christ, as in the third chapter, so Joshua's experience here is interpreted as a foreshadowing, as we said, of the messianic branch. Also, the role of the returned exiles here, the ones who brought back their gifts, in contributing to the restoration of the Jerusalem's cultus is interpreted as prefigurative of analogous developments in the Messianic age. Here are these Old Testament exiles, and they bring their tribute to Joshua in Jerusalem. And this is interpreted in terms of New Testament realities, where the exiles of humanity, we come bringing our tribute to the feet of the new Joshua, and so on. And so the two levels that we keep talking about are involved here in this chapter as well as elsewhere. The Old Testament situation, but only insofar as it is pointing to Messiah, the branch, and so forth. And I have some further comments trying then to show this typological relationship. In the Israelite theocracy, David's throne then was an earthly representative of God's heavenly throne, and the throne in the Holy of Holies to which the high priest had access was also a typological replica thereof. In the ultimate heavenly reality, Yahweh's temple and palace thrones are one, and that throne is the place of Christ's session at the right hand of God. All right. The reception of Messiah into the presence of the throne of God is another theme common to these two passages, chapters 3 and chapter 6, not just the coronation and the place on the throne, but is being received into the presence of God as a distinctive idea, which is present in both of these chapters, and you can read that and check it out for yourself. Let's move on now to chapter 11. This is the last of these spines. The centerpiece of the burdens And let's look at our Bibles here again then, chapter 11. This is very unusual. The other two, you had the high priest Joshua functioning as the symbol, the type of Christ. In this one, Zechariah himself plays that role. And as we noted then, this is the ultimate in terms of that particular pattern where he himself does engage actively in the vision, even now to the extent not just of Corinth commissioning someone else like Joshua, but of himself putting on the regalia. So here you have a sort of a second layer of symbolism where it doesn't then just speak about the royal attire of an Old Testament king, but talks about a shepherd. Now shepherd imagery is very common for royalty, as we know. And this is what the Lord my God says, pasture the flock marked for slaughter. So Zechariah now is commissioned to play the role of the shepherd. And before the thing is over, we see that he has the implements of a shepherd, the staff and so on. And evidently then the picture is that he dresses for the part, huh? He puts on the attire and so on. Before he's done, he's told to play a second role, to impersonate the evil shepherd, the bad shepherd. And when it comes to that in verse 15, it says, now take again, this time, the equipment of a foolish shepherd. So in each time, he sort of, as I said, dresses for the role he has to play. And in donning the outfit of the shepherd, which is then representing the royal office, there is then an investiture, literally an investiture of Zechariah. And he pastures the flock, and we'll want to study, I trust, if we can get to it, that particular passage. And he engages in judgment, and he judges the flock. This is one of those passages then which deal with the fall of Israel and with the judgment of Christ upon that community, and understandably so, because when he comes to them for an assessment of his services, and then we get the business of the 30 pieces of silver, which lead us into the whole thought of Judas's betrayal of Christ and so on. And so this whole dark passage then in biblical history of the rejection of Christ and Christ's rejection, therefore, of the community that rejects him is what's being portrayed here. And but it is, once again, then something that involves the general thought of investiture to a kingly judicial capacity. All right. Well, let's see what then I say about this. In this third major hinge section, the personal involvement of the prophet in the action is the most intense of all. That action, again, an investiture commissioning to royal priestly office, is not simply urged on by the prophet or even performed by him on someone else. He is here called upon to be himself the one so commissioned. He is instructed to play the part of the messianic priest-king, specifically the good shepherd sent on mission to the flock, shepherd being a familiar image of kingship. In keeping with the shepherd motif, the imagery of coronation and royal investiture found in the other two spine sections is translated into that of donning the outfit and taking the accoutrements suited to tending flocks. The shepherd's staff replaces the scepter, but the basic theme of official investiture is present again in this passage. So too is the other formal feature of the involvement of actual individuals that we've mentioned, whether contemporary or future. These features are not found in the burdens before or after chapter 11, but are peculiar to the three hinges. Then I have more detail, which I guess I'll let you read. Various other correspondences supplement this formal thematic evidence of the interrelationship of chapter 11 with the other two spine sections, and if you follow the details of that, I think you'll find them supportive of the thesis we're presenting here. Okay, that's then just trying to establish this. Any discussion, comment, questions?
Is it carrying the structure too far to see the specificity of the historical elements in the three hinges, connecting history, the interaction between history as we see it with heavenly reality seen in the visions and the burdens? Is that?
Well, I didn't quite get the point of that.
The two, I'm thinking now of the two-tier view of heavenly, the unseen heavenly reality, and then the historical earthly reality. Is the relationship between the hinges and the other material in the panel, visions and burdens, which are not, don't have specific historical action.
They don't have specific historical.
In some way symbolic of heavenly reality being connecting with historical reality, or is that just a stretch?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure that. What you do find is that in the visions, at least, in the first, third, fifth, and seventh visions, everyone but the second and the fourth, you do have that invisible heavenly setting as the setting of the thing. And so that two-register structure is present in a lot of the visions. For example, right away in the first one, you get the figure of the messianic rider on the red horse, together with the angel executives of the heavenly divine council. So the whole thought there is that that's the background of what's happening on earth, but they don't remain in heaven. These heavenly agents are on reconnaissance on planet Earth, and so you get the two registers all along. And as I say, and I don't know how it works out in the burdens, but in the visions, in 1, 3, 5, and 7, every other one, you do have that two registers. So that heaven is the sort of the setting. The immediate background for what happens on Earth. So the way it is in the Book of Revelation, however, where each major section begins with you're taken up into heaven, and heaven is opened, and he sees what's going on, and the prayers of the saints are going up there, and then in response to that, now something happens on Earth, and something in that order. Ready for a break? I know one guy that is. Now, the other thing in terms of structure that I would like to look at a little more closely is just a demonstration of the, this is a very, really a striking feature, I think, that you should have two chiasms like this in which those central spines then play such a prominent place and that match up with one another. And let's see if I can find, I think it's in the closing pages of the article that I take this theme up. And so what we would want to try to show is the parallelism between the first vision and the first section of the burdens and so forth down the line. Yeah. Here, there's a section that you'll find a couple of pages from the end in your book.
246,
parallelism between the visions. Is that it? Okay. So we've seen then that the visions and the burdens are both arranged in seven-unit chiasms. It remains to observe that the corresponding units of these two chiasms parallel each other topically. And the evidence adds weighty support to the case for the unitary character of the Book of Zechariah, and so on. So you start then, of course, with the centerpieces, which we've already looked at. We've studied the three spine sections and seen then how closely they correspond with one another. And so this one, the fourth vision, and the fourth section of the burdens, so we've already seen then how they correspond, and involving in each case the investitures of someone with a royal priestly office. Now then, the A units, the first units of the two chiasms, and maybe I'll just follow quickly through here. I'm getting tired and losing my, if I don't stick to something here. Each of the A units of the two chiasms present a mounted Messiah figure. That's an interesting thing. If you look at chapter 1, we have the rider on the red horse. And that's the figure of the one who is the judge of all the world, and his surveillance crew have gone through all of the world and bring back a report, and then on the basis of that report, he's ready to act in terms of universal judgment of all the nations. So that's quite a distinct big authority figure then that you get in chapter 1. And chapter 9 is then rather different, but nevertheless, again, in terms of symbolism, it's the same idea. It's a mounted figure, a mounted horseman. Only it's not a mounted horseman, it's a mounted donkeyman. So in chapter 9, then, the A section of the burdens, if you remember Zechariah 9, it's the one that begins with the call to Jerusalem, the daughters of Zion, to rejoice. Behold, your king comes to you. And now here's the idea of he comes as a mounted figure, but he's not the rider on the red horse here, the judge of all the earth. He's riding this donkey, and maybe, I don't know if you remember, this is something that would have come up in our prophets class when we were dealing with Genesis 49, the Shiloh passage, and it speaks about binding his donkey to the vine, and there was that peculiar expression for the donkey, the Ayar ben Atanot, that appears in Genesis 49, that messianic passage, and then appears again here in Zechariah 9, and only in these two passages, and then once again, of course, in the triumphal entry business in the gospel, where Jesus comes riding into Jerusalem on this donkey. And if you remember what we said about it, the significance of this donkey was that particular expression for him, Ayar ben Atanot, is one that described the breed of a donkey that was used when you were making covenants. So you would slay the animal and as part of the ratification of a covenant. And so that's the significance of Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the donkey. It was saying, why is he coming? He's coming to shed the blood of the covenant. And that's the one now that you have here in Zechariah 9. So they're a pair, but they're between them, they bring out the sufferings and the exaltation of Christ in an interesting way at the same time. So the rider on the red horse is also the rider on the covenant donkey here. And that was one feature then to tie together the two-way business. So presents a mounted Messiah figure, the Lord of Angels on the red horse, chapter 1, and the King of Israel on the donkey of covenant ratification, chapter 9. He's the ruler over all the nations. That's a theme that's present in 1:11 and again in 9, chapter 10. What is it in 9:10? He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea, from the river to the ends of the earth. So the universal sway of Messiah is in chapter 9 as well as in chapter 1. The Lord engages in a worldwide surveillance in each chapter. In chapter 1, it's through these other horsemen who appear. Along with the rider on the red horse, it mentions riders of other kinds of horses, red and the second color is some sort of chestnut, apparently, and the third is white. But in any case, in chapter 1, here is this worldwide surveillance that Messiah engages in. And then in chapter 9, the counterpart to this is the motif of the eyes of the Lord. And by the way, there's a misprint then in terms of a verse number there, at least in this article. I don't know if it got corrected. It should be 1:8 and through 11, and then 9 verse 1 instead of 9 verse 8. What got into the book?
I've lost where you are.
It's under that heading, parallelism between
right.
the...
And it's under the first one that says formal correspondence?
No, it'd be the third...
It'd be the third...
That's your heading.
Oh, parallelism, yeah.
And so the third paragraph is the one we're talking
yep.
about. And about the fifth line,
okay.
does it have 9:1 or 9:8?
It has 9:8.
Yeah, that's a mistake. That should be 9:1.
Okay.
And,
page 254, almost dead center. Fourth, the third full paragraph, fifth line down.
Agents known as his eyes. In ancient documents, you know, when the king would have a sort of a spy service that would be going out all over the world, keeping an eye on his vassals and so on. These were called the eyes of the king, private eye, public eye, whatever they were. But here in the Bible, it speaks about the eyes of the Lord. And it's a common the thing, especially when it's trying to comfort us with the thought that the eyes of the Lord roam to and fro through the all to show himself helpful in behalf of his people and so on. So there's the two-sidedness of the eyes of the Lord. He's looking for how he can help his people, but he's also looking for those who are in mischief so that he can deal with them in judgment. And here in chapter 9, it says the word of the Lord is so and so. Oh, no, this translation is no good. It says the eyes of men are on the Lord. I think the footnote has the eye of the Lord is on all mankind. The footnote is right instead of the text. It's a reference then to God as the one who is taking account of all things. All right. And he threatens to overthrow the nations who are secure in their strongholds and indifferent to God. That theme is common to both of them. Both of them have military imagery that makes allusion to the history of the conquest of Canaan. You can check out the passages. The Lord refers to my house in each case, promising to restore and defend it. Proclamation of good and joyful tidings to Jerusalem is commanded and performed in each case. So there's a whole series of verbal and thematic correspondences. And now, this is the opening unit of each seven. And I observe then that the opening unit of the burdens chiasm exhibits such numerous and notable parallels to the corresponding A unit of the visions, and this gives an unmistakable signal of the author's intention, namely to conduct us again along the same route traversed in the earlier part of his work. So I think, you know, I see that as what's going on. We said that the material in the burdens is so different in terms of presentation of the thing. That you wonder if it's the same author or not, but here you get a clear signal that it's the same author, and he's starting all over again with where he was before, and the second half of the overall diptych then turns out, and this is the way I would understand it, to be an apocalyptic recasting of the prophetic visions in the first half. So the visions are prophetic visions, and then in more of an apocalyptic mode, he goes back and goes along the same route that he's already traveled in the seven visions and goes to the same route again with this more spectacular type of imagery now. And, okay, moving on from the A sections to the B unit. The B unit of the chiasms under review, both visions and burdens, is each relatively brief. And if you look back in the visions, there's only four verses, chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. That would be your English numbering. And in the Hebrew text, it would be the last four verses of chapter 1. But it's only four verses, the second vision. And then here again in the second burden, it's only four verses. They're both short. And yet, short as they are, each one has two distinct parts to it. In chapter 2, it's a vision of the four horns, and then it's a vision of the four as I understand it, artisan or craftsman who cast down the horns. And in chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, again, there are rather two distinct sections if you check it out. Topically, they match, both speaking of the dispersal of Judah and of the Lord's judgment on those responsible for that. So the theme of the second members of these chiasms is the exile, the dispersion of God's people, which is explained as due in the one case to the sins of the people themselves, and in the other case it's accounted for, that is in chapter 9, it's accounted for in terms of the foreign nations, or vice versa, I guess. Chapter 2, it's the foreign nations that were the agents of their exile, and in chapter 10, 1 through 4, it's the sins of the people themselves. The third, the C units, chapter 2, 5 through 17, and chapter 10, verses 5 through 12, each involve a divine summons to return to the homeland, and it's an issue to those in distant exile. That's quite distinct, the theme, if you check that out. Why don't we do it? Chapter 2, 10 through 11. Shout and be glad, O daughter of Zion, for I am coming and I will live among you. Many nations will be joined with the Lord in that day and will become my people. I will live among you and you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent me to you. That's the third vision. And then the third burden would be, what did I say, chapter 10, verses 5. Through 12, but especially verse 11. Pictures of them. I will bring them to Gilead and Lebanon. There will not be room enough for them. They will pass through the Sea of Trouble, the surging sea. Sea will be subdued in all the depths of the Nile. And so there's a picture of the restoration. And I will bring them back from Egypt and gather them from Assyria and so on. This return accomplished through divine intervention is depicted as a new exodus in each case. Emphasis in each case falls on the astounding expansion of the covenant people. By reason of the multitudes, Jerusalem will be like an unwalled city in chapter 2, and the land will not be sufficient for them, chapter 10, verse 10. And this restoration in each case will register anew the covenantal election. In each case, it's the thought it will be the occasion for joy and song. So there's quite a list of correspondences in the C section. Then the fourth unit, of course, is the central hinge, and we needn't rehearse the similarities there. And then going beyond that to the final triad in each case, chapter 4, verses 1 through 14 in the visions, chapter 12, 1 through 13, 1 in the burdens, present the Lord as the power source for the victory over the world. Remember, the fourth chapter is the one about the menorah vision, and the key thought there is not by might, not by my power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. And that same theme now is matched here in chapter 12. A lot of emphasis on it is by the Lord's power that the world power will be brought low, and so on. And salvation is attributed specifically to the Spirit. Let's see what chapter 12, verse 10 says. We know what chapter 4 says. 12, 10, and I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem the Spirit of grace and supplication that results in good things. And in each case, it involves a work of grace, a display of divine favor. The Spirit transforms God's people into likeness of his own fiery glory, theophany, in each case. In chapter 4, the result is that the Spirit transforms God's people into burning lamps, which are like himself, a burning fire. And in chapter 12, the people of God are transformed again into flaming objects, torches and so on. Messiah, the mediator of the Spirit and salvation, is portrayed under the figure of the representatives of the royal house of David. It's Zerubbabel in chapter 4 and David himself in chapter 12. And another shared motif is the Lord's eyes looking with fostering favor on his servants in their struggles in the two sections. And not quite finally, but the B units, which would be the sixth vision, and then chapter 13, is judgment within Yeah, these are interesting. In chapter 5, it's the one where the flying scroll goes over the land and visits the house of all the apostates and destroys them. And then the second part of the vision, there's another flying object, the Apha container that carries the woman wickedness, representing the apostate community off to Babylon, where they're deposited. And so the sixth vision is very much one, the idea of the judgment on the Old Testament, the fall of Israel, huh? And their dispersion and their exile. And the corresponding sixth section of the burdens is in chapter 13, which is a very interesting one where it speaks about the dividing of the land into two-thirds and one-thirds, and all the land, declares the Lord, two-thirds will be struck down and perish, and yet only one-third will be left in it. And so you have the thought that there's only a remnant of the Old Testament community that survives, but the two-thirds of it are destroyed, which again I see as a prophecy of 70 AD, and certainly it matches up then with chapter 5. In each case, it's the fall of the old community. And then finally, the seventh units in each case is concerned with the establishment of God's universal reign. In the first part of chapter 6, it's the going forth of the chariots of judgment and wrath from between the two mountains of bronze, and they go throughout all of the earth and bring judgment, so that the final result is sort of the Sabbath of the Spirit, the God's Spirit, the glory Spirit who goes forth in the chariots of judgment, now brings peace. You know, the visions, the night visions start in the first one with the report of the horsemen that all the world is at peace. It's God's people who are supposed to be at peace, and the restless sea is supposed to be restless out there, the nations, but lo and behold, the sea of the nations, they're all at ease. And so that's the way the night visions start. But by the time you come to the end of the night visions with this seventh one, it's not the world that's at rest, but it's God's Spirit is at rest. Now he has gone forth. Now the nations are not at ease anymore. Now they have been suppressed. But it ends up with the thought that God's Spirit comes to rest. He comes to his Sabbath consummation here. And in the land of the north, in the very place where all the opposition was coming from, that now has become part of the extension. He started with the two mountains of bronze there at Jerusalem, and the judgment goes forth, and it's an extension of the sway of God's glory Spirit until now, even in the northland itself, where the Antichrist comes from, even there, God's Spirit now has come to his Sabbath rest. And so that's the way the night visions end, with that thought of general judgment. And, of course, chapter 14 is another such picture. And in terms of eschatology, I think we're dealing with with that theme of the final gathering of the nations that begins, and a day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. And there is some sort of an initial success, so that the city is captured, the houses ransacked, the women raped. Half the city will go into exile, the rest of the people will not be taken from the city, and then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations. So my understanding of this gathering is that it is the final gathering. It's the equivalent, let's say, of Ezekiel 38 and 39, where you have the Gog and Magog. It's the final gathering where they come and they besiege the city of Jerusalem, which is picked up then, of course, in Revelation 20, where Gog and Magog comes and surrounds the beloved city, the camp of the saints. So that's your eschatological final moment, is this Antichrist universal gathering, which is then triggers the parousia event, and that also is a gathering event, only it's now not the gathering of the nations to Jerusalem to attack Jerusalem, but it's the gathering of the saints into the new Jerusalem to be the people of God. And so and that's what chapter 14 is. It's like chapter 6, the opening picture there of a final judgment, a suppression of all the nations, which results then in the people of God being gathered there and celebrating their final tabernacles. So we'll be seeing that here there is sort of an inclusio too. The whole thing begins here in the first vision with a picture of the myrtles, which, will, as we'll suggest, brings out the theme of tabernacles and the myrtles associated with the materials that were used in the making of the booths and so on at the tabernacles. And so the whole prophecy of Zechariah begins with this theme of the tabernacles, the people of God dwelling with God dwelling in their midst and so on. And it closes in chapter 14 then with sort of a universal celebration of tabernacles. But in any case, the correspondence then is between the last of the visions and the last of the section on the burdens. So the conclusion then is the latter portion of canonical Zechariah, to which fashionable higher criticism would assign a different provenance from the first eight chapters, is found to be structurally interlocked with these earlier chapters by means of this intricate triple hinge mechanism. Within this framework, the two parts alleged to be of different origins constitute the finely balanced side panels flanking the central hinge. Such a curious overall structuring is rather clearly to be attributed to an original master plan for the whole work, not to a secondary redactional development, particularly since the central hinge is located in the supposedly earlier part. Something beyond the interests of literary artistry was involved in this compositional creation. At all the key hinge points in this arrangement, as we've already emphasized, the theme of the messianic priest-king is not only present but dominant. The formal structure was evidently designed to highlight the figure of the coming Christ, ordained to priestly sacrifice and subsequent highest royal glory, the one who is the central hinge and focus of prophetic revelation. So that for structure. Any clarification needed of what we're trying to argue here? All right. Now then, as we work through it, and we come to passages where we maybe have a question, you'll find that over and again, I'll try to tie in the corresponding members somewhere else in the structure, which, might be, let's say we're dealing with chapter one, that the corresponding places would be, in terms of this chiasm, to look down at the seventh vision. In terms of this arrangement, it would be a question of looking across to see what the first section here, and so that I think we'll find interesting and helpful. Now let's see what else we can do here. Let's go back to the introduction now, then turn to the actual text. Where did I steal this from? Whose pen was this? And if you have your Hebrew Bibles, now this would be a time to trot them out. We did read quickly through this section last time. And just before we read that, let's read a passage from Jeremiah, which we'll find that Zechariah is following very closely in his introduction, his first introduction here. And that's Jeremiah 25, verses 4 through 8. This passage is of special relevance, Jeremiah 25, because it's one of the two passages in Jeremiah chapter 25, the other is Jeremiah 29, where he predicts the 70 years exile, which is also part of Zechariah's comments in his first vision. But Jeremiah 25, 4 through 8. I trust you remember what's in Zechariah. And you'll recognize how close this is. Though the Lord has sent you all his servants, the prophets, again and again. You have not listened or paid any attention. It's almost word for word, what you get in Zechariah 1. You have not listened or paid any attention. They said, turn now, each of you, from your evil ways and your evil doings, and you can stay in the land the Lord gave to you and your fathers forever and ever. Do not follow other gods to serve and worship them. Do not provoke me to anger with your hands, with what your hands have made, and then I will not harm you. But you did not listen to me, declares the Lord, and you have provoked me with what your hands have made, and you have brought harm to yourselves. Therefore, the Lord Almighty says, because you have not listened to my words, then I will summon all the peoples of the north. And so here now comes the prediction of Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of the city and how it would last for 70 years. I go down to verse 12, and he says, verse 11 rather, this whole country will become a desolate wasteland, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. But then he comments that when the 70 years are up, Babylon will be destroyed. Cyrus will come along and he will destroy Babylon, and he will issue a decree for the Jews to return. As a matter of fact, in Jeremiah 29, Jeremiah again speaks of the 70 years, and here he does speak about this other event, that the restoration of the Jews will mark the end of that 70-year period. Okay, so you can see that Zechariah is following closely on the heels of Jeremiah, and at this point, echoing quite closely his language and his thought. All right. Now then, turning to the text. Right, Zechariah 1:1, in the eighth month, in this second year of Darius. So there's our second year of Darius. The word of the Lord was unto Zechariah, and we discussed, what it says here. He's the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, and so on. And we found that that some of the genealogies of Zechariah skipped that middle name, Berechiah, and jumped right to Iddo, the grandfather. And we also found in checking out those passages that Zechariah was a member of a priestly family, and he was the head of one of the priestly households later on. He's a young man here, but later on he became the head of a priestly household. So the word of the Lord comes to this member of the priestly family, younger contemporary of Haggai, and he says, Yahweh was angry against your fathers, Asef, and anger. So you use the cognate now to go with the verb in order to emphasize the verb. And so it's a way of saying the Lord was very angry with your father. So here's the situation that led up to the exile. They had broken the covenant, and of course the Lord was very angry with them. And verse 3, and you shall say unto them, Ko amir Yahweh Sivaot. And so here's the messenger formula that you are to start with and let them know that this is coming not just from you, but from the Lord. Now what you are to say to them is, return unto me, says the Lord of hosts, and I will return unto you. And notice what it's about four times you get this Ko amir Yahweh Sivaot, the emphasis that this is all coming from the Lord himself. And now then, you get this theme of return unto me, and I will return unto you. And let's pause for a moment now and ask ourselves in terms of covenantal principles, what kind of a principle is this? What he's saying, you will get blessings if you do such and so. You will be rewarded with this if you come through and have a proper behavior. If you obey the covenant stipulations, you will receive the covenant blessings. So do this and you will live. Do this and you will live, which is the works principle, and which Paul points to as quoting Leviticus 18:5, and says this is a different principle than you get in the gospel of justification by faith alone, by faith that it might be by grace. And so here is Zechariah, and he's still ministering under Moses. And the law came through Moses. Grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. But the law, the principle of inheritance by works, do this and you will live, is what comes under Moses. So here we are, back to that basic thing that we keep coming back to, and the necessity of analyzing the Mosaic economy in terms of its bottom grace layer and its top works layer. I repeat this endlessly because it is of such fundamental importance, and endless though the repetition is, I find all over the place it isn't sinking in, and people don't recognize what's going on. And so, in terms of national election, in terms of typological kingdom, there is a works principle. In terms of individual election, in terms of heaven itself, there is a grace principle. Both things happening simultaneously. And so the same people are involved in both levels. And here is, we talk about Daniel. Daniel's saved by grace in Christ. As an individual, he's going to heaven. Daniel, as a part of the national election, it becomes lo ami. He goes into exile in terms of the works principle. The nation corporately fails. Everyone who's part of that corporate nation is part of that situation. So the same figure simultaneously is involved in both things, but they are very different principles. This is gospel, which is justification by faith. This is do this and you will live. Return unto me and I will return unto you. Your enjoyment of the typological blessings, your continuing to enjoy the national election, is dependent on your works. Your fathers were stupid and wouldn't behave, and so the exile took place. And now here is Zechariah on this side of that break in the thing, and he's telling them, now don't behave like your fathers, mend your ways. But do they? No, they don't. And so judgment comes again, 78 AD. But happily, before that happens, this development has reached its climactic expression in the new covenant. New, not in the sense that the principle of grace wasn't operating before. It certainly was operating before, right from the fall on, the principle of grace was operating. But new vis-a-vis that second layer in the Old Covenant. So New Testament authors and Paul in his analysis of things speak of something new, not because they are not aware that there was grace under the Old Covenant, but because they are so impressed with this distinctive aspect of the Old Covenant that they tend to identify the Old Covenant with that level of things. And as in terms of that, it's a new covenant, as Jeremiah 31 puts it, that I'm going to make a new covenant with you, which is not like the old covenant, So what Paul's doing is what Jeremiah had already done, a new covenant, not like the old covenant. What was the old covenant? The old covenant was the one I made with your fathers when I brought them out of Egypt, and that was a covenant which they broke. I said unto them, do this and you will live, but they didn't do it, and so they didn't live, they died, and they broke that covenant. Okay, so that's what we encounter right away here. If we want to understand Zechariah's ministry, we have to understand that he is functioning under Moses, and he is pointing, of course, to Christ. He's showing how their failure under Moses is, Paul's terms, is driving them to Christ, and of course, Zechariah preaches Christ. We've seen how his whole book is structured in such a way as to preach Christ and the new covenant, but it's something which is made so desperately necessary by the failure in terms of the principle operating under the old covenant. Haggai had made a reference to this old covenant. I mean, that's what I'm trying to show you, that Zechariah, in terms of covenantal analysis, is functioning under this old covenant made at Sinai. And you know, this is one of those contexts where Haggai is already picturing in terms of the developments of the temple, the greater developments of the New Testament temple and so on. But here he says now that the Hebrew begins with et hadavar, and how to handle the et, which is often the sign of the direct object. And as for the word, and he's referring to the covenant. He calls it the davar. As for the word, asher karati, which literally I cut. And in your Hebrew, you may remember the idiom for making a covenant is karat berit. You cut a covenant. So here he refers to the covenant as something which was cut. He calls it the word which I cut, the equivalent of the covenant that I made. So here is that covenant which I made with you in your going forth from Egypt. Sounds very much like Jeremiah 31. Not like the covenant I made with your fathers when they went forth from Egypt. So now he refers to that covenant which I made with you when you're going forth from Egypt. And now the next line has been, I think, misunderstood. If you have an English version there, anyone, would you maybe read for me the second part of verse 5 there? Okay. So, but my spirit remains among you. So what the connection is now with the covenant that I made with your fathers and isn't all that clear. And actually what is here is a picturesque, concrete delineation of what happened at Sinai. Ruach, spirit, you know, is a shorthand, of course, for the theophany. What happened at Sinai was that the theophanic glory was present there, and here's a reference to it, and the verb here is the verb amad in Hebrew. It's a participle omitted, and my spirit, now the thought is not that now my spirit is inside of you. That's not the point here. It's that I made this covenant with you, and in making it, you know, God commits himself by oath, and the people are committing themselves by oath, and the thought is that God's theophanic spirit stood there, and my spirit stood there in the midst of you. Don't be afraid. The passage then is just trying to show that God has made his covenantal commitments. He has made his covenantal arrangements with them, and he will be true to them. And so they can be sure that if they do this, they will live. He has made those commitments to them. And so the translation would be, this is now the arrangement, the commitments that I made with you when you came forth from Egypt, and my spirit was standing there, the pillar, you know, the glory spirit, theophany, is described in terms of the pillar of cloud and fire. The pillars represent the feet of God, the two things that stood there. And in the Bible, when God is pictured as standing there, it's very frequently the idea that he's standing there to take an oath, as in Revelation 10, where the Christ figure is standing with his feet on the land and the sea, and he lifts up his hands to heaven and takes an oath. I think that's the picture here. It's of God making his covenantal commitments to them at Sinai. But coming back then to Zechariah, he then articulates the principle of that Sinaitic covenant in terms of do this and you will live. Then going on to verse 4, now the lesson from the past. This, by the way, is one of the points that you'll find in common between the two introductions. I didn't say much about the parallelism between the two introductions in the visions and in the burdens, but in my article I do. And one of the points of commonness between them is how in each case they refer to the lessons of the past, and most especially they refer to the lessons of the days when Israel was breaking the covenants and the prophets were coming unto them and they wouldn't listen to them and so on. So here we get that thought. So don't be like your fathers, literally, which they called unto them the former prophets, saying, unto whom the former prophets cried out, saying, go Amir Yahweh Sivaot, thus says the Lord of hosts, return on, I pray thee, from your wicked deeds and your evil doings. And they did not hearken, and they did not listen, very much like the Jeremiah passage. Unto me says the Lord. And then verses 5 and 6. So your fathers, the ones who didn't have the sense to obey, where are they? And now here, if you remember, we did suggest the alternative translations of the next line. Your fathers, where are they? One translation would be, and the prophets too, do they live forever? The implication being, no, they don't live forever. So both the recipients of revelation and the agents of revelation, your fathers and the prophets, they all die. But you have to recognize that God's word didn't fail. But my words and my decrees, which I commanded through my servants, the prophets, didn't they come true? Yeah, the fathers and even the prophets have come and gone. They don't abide forever, but my word abides forever is the thought, which of course would be a common biblical conception. Is it not that they overtook your fathers? And ultimately then your fathers had to come and acknowledge that God's word spoken through the prophets was true, that his covenant threats were not empty, and that for their failure to keep covenant, they did eventually fall. So that's one way of taking it, and perhaps that's the right way. But there is another option, because there are a couple of terms here that where the Hebrew would allow us a slightly different rendering. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, then, if you look at your Hebrew text after prophets, it has the interrogative element in Hebrew, ha. Is it that they live forever? But the first grammatical point to observe is that this interrogative sometimes has the force of is it not that? Which could be expressed as ha, lo, instead of ha. But it can mean, is it not that? And so the contrast would be not between the fathers and the prophets on one side as over against the word of God on the other, but it would be in terms of the fathers over against the prophets, and the prophets then are aligned with the word of the prophets. So you would translate this way, your fathers, where are they? Huh? But the prophets, don't they live forever? Of course, they live forever in the word that they spoke, because their word comes true. And so the next word, the first word in verse 6, also is capable of two different translations. So instead of translating it, but, it can be also translated surely. So instead of translating your fathers, where are they, and the prophets, do they live forever? No, they don't. But my word abides forever. You would translate the fathers, do they live forever? No, they don't. But as for the prophets, don't they live forever? Of course they do. Surely they do. And my words and decrees which they spoke abide and come true. There is an ancient similar thought in some Egyptian text from the, they're from both the first and second millennium, but it refers to the ancient sages among the Egyptians, a couple of fellows named Imhotep and another Hardedef, and it reads, as for those learned scribes, here were the old wise men, and as for those learned scribes, since the time which came after the gods, their names have come to be lasting forever. Although they themselves have gone, they did not make for themselves pyramids of metal with tombstones of iron. They were not able to leave heirs and children, but they made heirs for themselves in writings and in the wisdom literature which they left. Is there any one of you like any of these prophets? They are gone, forgotten, but their names, through their writings, cause them to be remembered. That would be something similar to that the prophets live on forever in their words, especially since their words are the word of God. So that would be another way of rendering the passage, taking advantage of a couple of different alternatives with two different Hebrew words here. In either case, whether the prophets are thought then as the ones who live forever or not as the word of God certainly is presented here as that which lives forever, which has come true. And therefore, this new generation should be aware that these warnings, which the old prophets had issued and which now Zechariah is issuing, turn unto me and I will return unto you. Don't turn unto me and I won't return unto you. They must recognize that that this will come to pass. And just as their fathers ultimately had to confess that God's word was fulfilled, so you people are going to ultimately have to recognize that our word to you will also be fulfilled. And they returned. Okay, that so that takes us through the introduction and brings us then in verse 7 to the first of the visions, and I guess we'll hold off on that. Okay. Now your kiddies may go home.